let's finish off the Rav. Then we're going to do Chabad and then close with a little bit of Rav Amital and a little other observations. Does anyone have any questions from last time? Okay. Well, since this class is not on philosophy of the Rav, but the relationship of modern orthodoxy, if it was on philosophy of the Rav, we would then have six classes devoted to halachic man, ubakashta misham, and madadech midod. Those are his basic three philosophic works, each one taking, or together, six classes worth to really present his views. But what I am doing now is giving where it fits into modern orthodoxy rather than the philosophic elements. First of all, the Rav had writings already in the 1930s and early 40s, the most famous of which is Halachic Mind, which never came out until the end of his life because the Rav himself knew that was a first draft. It has various titles floating around called Is a Philosophy of Halacha Possible? He also footnoted in several of his earlier works that there was a multi-logic approach to halacha. And that work, the question is, should it have come out, should it not have come out? Because in that approach, in that book, Halachic Mind, he talks about how there are multiple perspectives, multiple constructions of epistemology, which he retracted from already by Halachic Man. So no, when that came out at the end of the 80s, there were a lot of very excited people because it made the Rav into much more of a pluralist. But it doesn't agree with his later writings. I mean, that's very clear. He was experimenting with the best of Weimar Germany philosophy. The book was written entirely within those terms. And then he retracted from it. And people generally only usually quote the last paragraph that a philosophy of halacha has yet to be written. But anyone who actually reads it, it's a much more individualistic and pluralistic work. Because he says there are multiple perspectives, and halacha can be its own perspective, just like science, or multiple versions of science. He also, within that, points out the same way the medievals had their construct, the Maimonidean approach. We have our construct, which has to be very different. He does emphasize difference there. But the real work that he's known for is Halachic Man. Okay, that is one of the unique 20th century visions of halachic, traditional, orthodox Judaism, emphasizing the role of halacha as cognitive, rational, as a science. Now, the formal structure of the first part of the book is a tension between homo religious, the religious figure, and the cognitive approach, the scientific approach. And instead, the Rav is going to argue for the halachic approach that is going to have elements of both of them. So this book, he's already coming in influenced by Rudolf Otto, that there's the idea of the holy. There's an autonomous religious realm. He's also influenced by neo-Kantianism, that science is objective, abstract, ideal, not grounded in the real world.
You're saying that Otto will represent homo religiosus and neo-Kantianism represent the...
No, just let me finish the thing. He's coming in with that as his starting point. he then says halachic man is a unique type that has elements of both. And into halachic man, Mimir Otto wrote right after the First World War, and Cohen wrote a decade before that. All of the critiques of Otto and Cohen are already within halachic man. I mean, those are not original to the Rav, even though they're not read in America, but all the critiques where neo-Kantianism is too abstract is not presented as the cognitive man's position, it's presented as halachic man's position. Or all the critiques where Otto is too passive, too much Protestant dependency on the divine, all the critiques of Bultmann and Barth against mysticism and the dependency in Otto are already put within halachic man's mouth. So Nikolai Hartmann and Shaler's critiques of neo-Kantianism and Barth and Brunner's critiques of homo religios are all in halachic man's mouth. So that's why it wasn't a simple answer. For the religious elements that matter, like I said, if we wanted to, we could spend the rest of the evening talking specifically about those two sentences. But the other points that are important here is footnote 4, right on the start, where it says that religion is not about emotions, relieving tensions, dealing with sentimentality, dealing with healing or well-being. It was a clear part of the Rav's worldview, not part of modern Orthodoxy's worldview.
Lamb takes it. I mean, obviously, like, he wrote books that were diametrically opposed to this.
Right.
But he also says in his other books, In Faith and Doubt, like, really, we're not supposed to be better off because of Flacham, we're not supposed to be better off because of religion.
That's right. So that will play an undercurrent, but it's not as strong as the Rav actually takes it to mean. The Rav clearly wanted it to be outside of any contribution to daily life. So that's a very important sentence, or not sentence, page and a half, that has a life of its own. Now halachic man, unlike halachic mind, is going to merge religion, science, Rambam, neo-Kantianism, and existentialism as one. The list can go on with other things. So unlike halachic mind, where these things are epistemologically separate, this book, there's an equation sign drawn between Rambam, Hermann Cohen, existentialism, science, religion. It all becomes one single epistemological world. Now, there's a technical problem with that, is because a lot of the very works of Soloveitchik is quoting to prove these points in the book don't agree with that. I mean, they clearly thought they were arguing. When Shaler was writing and saying that neo-Kantianism was too abstract, he thought he was doing an act of critique. So this book not only harmonizes, it also doesn't, it takes out all the elements of critique from the works that he's using, which makes it ever hard, it becomes a non-reproducible work. Because if you gathered all the footnotes there, they would all say they're arguing. Here it becomes this nice harmonious approach. And that does color all of his students, because there is, for as much as he says, the world is paradox, tension, the Rav is a big harmonizer, so whether the modern Orthodox, centrists, kibbutz adati, or any other readings of the Rav, there's a sense that everything can be harmonized. Yes?
Do I feel like that the Rav is into tension, but he's only into one tension. Like, he'll say, well, you know, we can have Tosos and the Rambam arguing, or we can have Homo Religiosus and Cognitive Men arguing, but you can't go and say there's this whole monophonic thing and there's all these little nuances, and, you know, really the Tosos really doesn't agree with Tosos totally because, you know, feels slightly different.
Okay, so the point is halachic mind leaves options for those sort of directions which by 44, 45 are not there anymore. There is that moment beforehand where things were still separate. Okay, some other elements here. Just to give you the Herman Cohen's idea that we could ever reach the absolute, that we're all aspiring toward the limit. We're actually infinitesimals, but we teach calculus differently now. But the idea that we are forever going toward the infinitesimals becomes combined with the Rambam's idea of Galoy v'Nistar, revealed and hidden at the same time, meaning you never reach the true ideal. It's ever receding. Cognition becomes identified with creativity. Abstraction will be identified with democracy, ethics, this world. The book has an undercurrent of anti-American pragmatism inherited from German philosophy. I should have really mentioned that in footnote 4. Anti-pragmatism. Learning Gemara, one comprehends, grasps, and becomes one with the will and wisdom of the divine. And for that, he quotes Tanya.
That even if it doesn't happen ever.
But he, I mean, he's quoting in the Tanya chapter 5, where that you come to God through Torah, and that's another point about halachic man. It claims to be doing mitnagdut the Vilna Gaon nefesh achayim, and it's much closer to Tanya in its approach. Actual nefesh achayim. When you are learning Torah, you are affecting higher olamot. There's clear acts of theurgy going on. Prophecy is a clearly meta-rational state. The role of yira, piety, and religion is very important in the Nefesh HaChayim. The view of mitnagdut of this book becomes very this-worldly Kantian, and that's had a major effect on the readers from every school and every movement, is that mitnagdut becomes reread as intellectual. And that's when Alan Nadler wrote an article like a decade ago called Rav Soloveitchik Not a Misnaged. It did not have a warm reception in many circles because it points out the obvious, that mitnagdut was about living Rumo Shalom, living Yirat Shemayim. It was really the world of Rav Aaron Cutler, and this is a rather democratic, this worldly cognitive work. Very far from Nefesh HaChayim. What else? Okay, the old halachic man finds Kedusha in this world. He's democratic. He doesn't care about the transcendental realms. That's a big part of the Rav. Kedusha is in the here and now, and it's in the democratic. Several offshoots of that become, one, the projecting onto the Grod Nefesh HaChayim as if they were not interested in Kabbalah and the other worlds. It becomes this language of Kedusha is a big part of, for example, Saul Berman's opening Eidah lectures for the first conferences, that Kedusha means we care about democracy in this world and everybody. That's taken from those paragraphs. But once again, Ein Kedusha B'li Hachana, as the Rav used to make the posters all over Maimonides based on the Rav, that this Kedusha doesn't happen automatically. It happens by your submission to this ideal halachic universe. Torah is about maxims, norms, actions, having the freedom to recreate yourself into the halachic model. And the latter part of the book is the part that, especially the pages 99, 100, 101, of the importance of the role of creativity, the role of abstract thinking, and one's freedom within this process, and that defines halachic man. So where the first part is presenting halachic man as both the epistemology and the creation of Kedusha, the second part of the book talks about the creative element of halacha. Okay. The second major work, which was written at the exact same time, came out called Ubkashta Misham. It was originally called Isha Elohim, among its one of its several earlier titles, when it was still floating around in manuscript. And to give you an introduction to this work, Isha Elohim, that actual phrase coming from Pirkei D'Rav Eliezer, is that Moshe became Isha Elohim because God followed his own actions. Now, since I happen to be reading Heschel's The New Translation of Torah from Heaven, that the explanations of what that could possibly mean become somewhat of a tension between those who actually interpret it theurgically, that you affect the divine, everyone from Rabbi Akiva all the way up to Nefesh Chaim, or do you take it to mean something more rational, in that one could have a religious experience? The Rav and Isha Elohim Ubakashta Misham takes it to mean how the halachic approach and the creativity in halacha affects the divine. And that's why I pointed out it becomes a very creative rereading of Chazal.
So halachic process affects God?
Yes, because the Isha Halacha is creating halacha. Now the book opens up, as do others, about the tension between our Kantian knowledge of God and our more existential needs. There's a tension. The Rav plays this theme in variations in the beginning about the there's also love within the Aristotelian corpus, meaning the Rambam has Eros in him. Now, Ubakashta Misham played less of an influence because it was written in Hebrew, and it's still in Hebrew. And, like I said, very few are able to read Ubakashta Misham. And the overall form of the book, just to give you the Rav's ideas, is the first third of the book is saying how coming to God, coming to the transcendent, is a universal ability of mankind through the cosmic, through the ethical, through the a priori, through experiential. Everyone has self-transcendence. The second third goes into how it's truly only available in the halachic realm, and the halachic realm brings you to a much higher state, takes you from these natural states into the ones that are true growth, catharsis, out of the natural realm and into the truly ethical religious realm. And that second third, he works through a variety of halachic transformations, nisayon, experience and suffering, churban, destruction, pachad, fear, prayer, how you learn to take your existential death states and learn to articulate them, because without halacha you wouldn't know how to articulate your inner states. I mean, he assumes that basically all we can do is grunt without in our natural state if we didn't have halacha. It's always about reaching the higher levels. I mean, there's a basic background here of taking Kierkegaard's and then Karl Barth's, Kierkegaard, Otto, and Karl Barth's, that the numinist needs a charismatic, meaning the religious experience needs an actual proclamation, revelation, in order to ground it. And the end of that second third talks about the prophetic process, in which prophecy is confronting the divine, in which we are now confronted beings, revelation in the Rav, both here and confrontation, is about a human state of realizing you can't be in the natural existence, but you have to be a confronted person by revelation. You have to be transformed by it. The last third of the book, starts again talking about halacha b'drachav, yud gimel midot, how we make ourselves ethical figures, how prayer and Talmud Torah perfect us. Leading up to prophecy and prayer and Talmud Torah are in continuity. And then the very last, final paragraph, where the true halachic figure is now creating the world that God is listening to, and the true halachic figure and the divine will becomes one. Know that it's misprinted in our edition, that it should be Ritzo Note, and in our edition it's printed as Ritzi Ni. Meaning which even Americans, very few Americans even catch the misprint. Israelis point that out immediately. How could no American catch that? It's a big difference, right. But that even shows you part of the problem with it. This gives you a nice overview of his philosophy. It would be lovely to spend two sessions on it completely, but it gives you a grounding in the Rav's own thinking. Yes?
True halachic figure synchronizes with God.
But the one that put the Rav on the map was Lonely Man of Faith, given 64, floating around 65, published 67, because that was his first work in English. Finally, something that people in America could read. After Lonely Man of Faith, Then the Rav made his way into books on Jewish thought, into encyclopedia articles. His Only Be With a Lonely Man of Faith did now, could Borowitz have a chapter in his Choices Modern Jews Make on Rav Soloveitchik. Only from that point would he be mentioned in Judaism and midstream, because there was an English work of his and it used the word modern continuously. There were all sorts of theories floating around in the 70s and 80s as if the Rav had changed his mind from his earlier halachic work, not realizing that a lot of these same existential modern themes were already in Ubakashta Misham or in a lot of the early writings. It was just a publication quirk that was the only thing that came out in English and the first thing that came out in English. And it gave a very one-sided image of the Rav as if he was entirely an existentialist. So talking a little bit about Lonely Man of Faith as a book that influenced people. He talks about modern man being in isolation, that the man of faith has to go and seek hope. And why is modern man in isolation? One, because of the very nature of existence, as we're taught by Kierkegaard. Two, for the stress and cares of modern life. Three, the alienation of Western man from religion. And he says he'll deal with these in reverse order. Now, that sort of opening alone made Rav Soloveitchik as a Rosh Yeshiva into a very rare figure, because even to talk about Kierkegaardian loneliness or modern man's stress really separated him out from all other Rosh Yeshiva and therefore all academic, liberal, philosophic readings of the 1970s. Really, because this was the only thing that was out there from this enigmatic figure whose writings had not been published. It became, you know, the image of the Rav from this essay was as the modernist. And he talks, as he does in all his writings, that modern man is self-serving and utilitarian. And then he sets up a typology of Adam 1 and Adam 2. Now, once again, part of it is Adam 1 and Adam 2 comes from Karl Barth. You find it in Bonhoeffer. You find it in Benno Yaakov discusses it. Franz Rosenzweig discusses it. But he gets it from Karl Barth. And part of the way American academia was set up, that even if you majored in philosophy, you studied Nietzsche, Kierkegaard, you then jumped to Ayer, Nagel, whoever you were jumping to, but you weren't going to read the German theologians of the 1920s and 30s. The Rav did. So Adam 1 and Adam 2 is a category from dialectic theology. We'll talk first in front of the Rav, and then we'll come back to what dialectic theology is. So Adam 1 is our element of life that's intelligent, functionality, the mind, interested in this world, leading a dignified existence, responsibility, free will, creating civilization, aesthetics, politics, curing disease, discovering scientific formula, helping the needy, embracing all of civilization. And it's important to point out now that Lonely Man of Faith does not talk about Talmud Torah. And that stands in contrast to a lot of his other writings or oral discourses. So that creates that tension right there. Adam, too, in contrast, looks for the meaning of life, looks for awe, looks for mystical encounter, looks for something that goes beyond the social, looks for sacrificial redemptive acts. Meaning, so where Adam 1 is our natural ability to be dignified, Adam 2 is our need for redemption. Or to reiterate that in other terms, Adam 1 is redeemed because we're Tzelem Elohim, because God has already given up a natural order. It's not the positivistic and scientific universe. It's only because God has grounded a certain order in the universe. So even though Adam 1 and Adam 2 is a Karl Barth distinction, the content of Adam 1 is coming from Emil Brunner's writings on God gave us this ability to lead a dignified existence. While Adam 2 is this redemption, we've got to move beyond it. And we've got to cultivate the self. We've got to truly reach our sense of finding meaning, or else we will be alienated and neurotic. A lonely man of faith keeps the words metaphysical and ontological to a minimum. It was edited properly because, unlike some of the later stuff that's coming out now, in which ontological and metaphysical could be every other line, having no particular meaning in English, this one, it was kept in its proper place to say that this, you know, meaning it was used as a descent, you know, as a statement at the end of a section saying this is the way the world works. And the example that the Rav gives for isolation is one could be in Times Square on New Year's Eve with the masses watching the New Year's Eve celebrations. And one could, even among all those crowds of people, you could still feel lonely. This essay is filled with those sort of incredibly secular, all-American imagery. You know, once again, to get a Rosh Hashiva telling you about, you could be sitting there in Times Square or celebrating New Year's Eve and feel lonely. Was that itself was a message for many people. Like any of you?
The imagery of the astronaut.
The imagery of the astronaut, any of this imagery. It was modern American imagery. It was the imagery of the 60s. And so we overcome our alienation by leading a redeemed religious life. To question, too, about the stress of care and cares of modern life. In that, he will teach, at that point, talks about covenant. We've got to be free agents. We've got to freely build covenantal relationship with the divine in our act of creatively creating religion in the world. We have to be partners with God rather than isolated modern individuals. These are the paragraphs that David Hartman is going to take off on and use that about us having to be free partners with God. We need personal conviction. We need experience. We're against mysticism. Don't think prophecy is in any way mystical. Prayer, prophecy are all covenantal acts of partners standing face to face in dialogue, in confrontation, as a human encounter. Prayer is about confronting the divine. Therefore, you should know that nothing in prayer is symbolic. Nothing in prayer is metaphysical. Nothing in prayer is magical, and it never has been within Judaism or the Halacha. We talked about the implicit creating conundrums by making broad statements like that. Prayer is about the ethical moral message. The prayer must be applied to all people in all situations. I mean, prayer becomes a form of typology, of standing before the divine. And then in the Rose Writings, you'll find typologies of Abraham, Moshe, Eliyahu, Elisha, giving you different typologies. The Rav says, unlike Christianity, Jewish prayer is ethical. And that becomes the great paradox, because that's Karl Barth's critique of Schleiermacher. Karl Barth gets up there and says, too true Christian prayer is ethical, unlike the pietist. The...
What does it mean that prayer is ethical?
That prayer is about, prayer is all about human needs and human values concretized within the world.
So we said in the prayer class, he's the first thinker to incorporate human needs into prayer.
In the first Orthodox thinker to do that.
And what's the thing?
Meaning Herman Cohen will have elements of this already.
And what's the Schleiermacher thing?
It means all dependence. It's all the experience
of
it.
What was the Maisa? Like, what was the argument?
No, because the dialectic theologians criticize European Protestantism for being too God-centered and not being man-centered. And the Rav makes that the very definition of Judaism as opposed to Christianity.
This is what they love with the European Protestants.
Mm-hmm.
And Schleiermacher is the European Protestant.
Right. But the fact that he's getting it from later Protestants... that never comes out.
But
yes.
How is it theocentric?
For the Rav is not. The Rav is anthropocentric.
Oh,
no, the Rav is very anthropocentric. He holds we can't capture things with words. The depths of our existential emotions. Within, and this is quoting from Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, and various other late 19th century fin de siècle sense of our alienation. We can put things in words. We have no vocabulary to speak of our deep states, if not for halacha. And another one of the problems here is that where the Rav comes off now is incredibly modern and existential, and, you know, who could say these things? On the other hand, to be writing this, for this to come out in 67, when you could easily, at that point, most literature in America was incredibly confessionatory, talking about emotions, relationships, you know, whether you are putting Denise Levertov or Philip Roth or anyone... But anyone in that camp, any poet, any literary figure, any philosopher, putting Sartre, Jaspers, anyone who writes thousands of pages on the human condition, the Rav is still at that point that we are inarticulate and have nothing to say, as if we're still in the 1890s. He is still in the alienation of Strindberg or Ibsen into the 1960s. Even though we had already had decades and decades of endless trying to capture human emotions. You know, Bob Dylan, whoever you're going to think of, you know, was trying to capture human emotions for quite a long time by this point.
But is that a commentary on the Rav or on, like, why did our community not care?
No, this was seen as exciting, but at the same time it led to that implicit... If you can say, oh, it's about our existential emotions, therefore you're going to have one interpretation that says the Rav and, you know, whichever literary figure are the same, and let's go in that direction. Or another one saying, no, all we can read is 19th century literature. So even within liberal interpretations of the Rav, you've got a problem.
Why do you say we can only read 19th century?
There are enough people saying there are, you know, let's only look at Dostoevsky, let's stay at that moment. Rather than the fact that, you know, rather than picking up a Norton's anthology of 20th century lit or 20th century poetry, which has already been grappling with these issues for decades. more than decades, for almost 100 years already. So even, let's say, within the liberal interpretation, the Rav wanted you to read literature, it leads to different groups that does not come up with a clear message. He then returns to the first of his reasons for our alienation, the Kierkegaardian, that we're finite beings before an infinite divine. We are beings unto death, and we have a sickness unto death.
Beings unto death, like Kierkegaard?
Yes.
Beings unto death, like Heidegger?
Well, that becomes the point. That it's probably closer to Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, but he quotes Kierkegaard in the text and footnotes to Heidegger via Hugo Bergman.
Is this where Carmine's Kierkegaard thing comes from?
Yes. Kierkegaard is the named protagonist of the text. It is the open, and it was part of the American canon also.
As opposed to Nietzsche? Or?
No, as opposed to what's the things from Weimar Germany, as opposed to a lot of the Heidegger, which had not been translated. Even though Being in Time was translated very early, Americans really didn't know most of Heidegger's writings until the basic writings came out in...
Is that like a post-war?
In whatever that was, 1970 something.
Is that like a post-war antipathy towards Germans?
Towards Germans, right.
Okay.
So a lot of the German elements here did not come out. Or like a lot of the elements that comes out in Max Scheler's Man's Good Place in the Cosmos. It does not come out in the discussions. In the general sense that man is a small being, and it's a paradox before his confronting the general infinity of the divine. That statement you find, let's go to, is in Eliezer Berkowitz, is in Marvin Fox, it's in a lot of modern Orthodox thinkers, but it's coming from all different roots, not just from Kierkegaard. For example, Eliezer Berkowitz cites at this one the Bhagavad Gita. You know, God created 100 million suns before us, small little finite beings. Okay. Now, the solution to this, for the Rav, is to become part of the Masorah. To overcome our human isolation by becoming part of a covenantal community where past, present, and future all merge into one. Now that phrase, covenantal community, itself has a complex statement because on one hand that's straight out of Hermann Cohen. Hermann Cohen says the messianic quest is to create community, build things in the real world, and that was Cohen's critique of 19th century nihilism. Meaning Hermann Cohen would critique Nietzsche's nihilism by saying, no, you become part of the community and build toward messianism. It becomes, in the very famous debate in Davos in the 20s between Ernest Cassirer, the neo-Kantian, and Martin Heidegger about the meaning of life, Heidegger says we're all beings unto death, and we've got to realize that, and there is no solution. And Ernest Cassirer, then the Kantian, gets up there and says, no, we are all projecting into the future, and we look forward through a redemption by building community. So the Rav is clearly on the neo-Kantian side, even if the text keeps talking about this Kierkegaardian paradox, the Rav is citing the neo-Kantian solution to it. But beyond that, the actual phrase covenantal community comes from Karl Barth. Karl Barth used the church as a covenantal community outside of the real world. And you know, the Christian church should not be judged by individual churches or church history, but should be judged by this tradition in which all generations speak as one, past, present, and future, in which one now finds one's true redemption and trans defines the infinite. Yes?
I got that from a lot from C.S. Lewis.
Hmm. Okay. You will find similar statements in T.S. Eliot and in C.S. Lewis.
Anyone with initials.
All of them read by Americans, but that wasn't the Rav's source. Okay? So Rabbi Carmi and Rabbi Lichtenstein will cite C.S. Lewis, as will now Pope Benedict cite C.S. Lewis. The Rav was taking it from Karl Barth.
Pope Benedict.
Okay, that's.
But John Paul would take it from Karl Barth. No.
That okay. That's right. That's. I mean, we can leave this. And I once got to give a lecture someplace, and I was talking about Max Shaler and Barth and things. And I opened at some point in the lecture and said, "What does Heschel, the Rav, and the Pope have in common?" And I wanted to talk to give my answer. They're all using Barth and Shaler in different ways. Someone screamed, "No, they're all born in Poland," which had the rest of the room on the floor. And,
they walk into a bar.
So, okay. The Rav speaks about halacha in universal terms. At no point mentions particularism in this essay, leading Borowitz to the question, does halacha apply to non-Jews and the rest of the world? Which is a funny question, because the Rav has some incredibly particularistic essays also. The Rav in this essay is about oscillation, a continuous tension between the particular and the universal, the secular and the religious. Many interpreters take one side. Majestic man needs a sacrificial act. The sacrificial man of Adam II needs to live in the real world. And in this, both modern Orthodox and centrists are all rather happy camper this worldly. They don't tend to live as isolated individuals in the Rav sense. There's an undercurrent to the essay rejecting Musar, rejecting anything even close to it about needing, about you know, living for the other world or being rotten to the core that needs to be corrected. He rejects all dealing with eschatology or the end of days. There is in this essay, a lot of language of absurd, paradox, leaps of faith. But once again, for leaps of faith for Kierkegaard were all because you're leaping into an abyss, rejecting the ethical, the norm, and the community. Since this essay never relinquishes the norm, the community, the communal, You have a problem with the use of paradox, and that's why, for example, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein will just drop the paradox, because if you're spending your life building a covenantal community of halacha, there really isn't paradox. The essay at the end talks about how religion is untranslatable into modern categories. I mean, back to the bigger question, the very modernity makes religion untranslatable. And the image he gives is this great ending image of Eliyahu, who he is untranslatable. He has the kol tamama daka. But it's Elisha who has to go into the majestic life, into the real world. The mantle has to be passed forward. And the true modern man of faith is a privileged status of having the sacrificial role, the redemption of Eliyahu, but having to go forward like Elisha into the modern world. Now, where this essay is quoted heavily by modern Orthodox, by Kibbutz Adati uses this as their heter for secular studies, later figures like Eliezer Goldman. It's heavily quoted by Datiyim Hadashim and Open Orthodoxy. It is ignored by centrists. This is not the essay they like, because once again, it doesn't play up Torah. It doesn't play up those elements. Quick questions on that?
Borowitz's thing.
Do you mean a book?
Yeah. When the Rav says to build a covenantal community, why does halacha have to be at the center of it? In other words, if I want to build now like my Islamic ummah, my mosque, and like really be my
That was Borowitz's question. And that's the point. It's left out of this essay. Yes.
By any chance, is this concept of the absurd anything like Chinese concept?
Is it anything like the answer is, it's part of the language. The Rav had read Hugo Bergman's book on existentialism, I think from Kierkegaard to Camus. I think that may actually be the title of it.
Is it in English?
I don't remember. I think only in Hebrew.
No.
Okay. I mean, the Rav had read versions of about Camus, but the point is, you know, Camus, whether Sisyphusian quests or his absurdity, is not, if you, as long as you have a covenantal community, you don't have absurdity. Camus doesn't have community.
But is it the same idea of indifference that Camus talks about?
No, here we have great sacrificial building of community like Elisha. There is no indifference.
Uh-huh. Obviously, the Rav never read his later works.
Right.
Because he has a sense of community.
What?
Camus does have an idea of community.
That's right. So therefore, you can find later interpreters saying, oh, the mother Rav must have read that writing or that writing, but... but it's not really there.
But is it the same idea of like it's not something in man, but it's man's confrontation to the world, so to speak?
Yeah. But he's getting it from Bergman more. Okay. The essays that centrists do read are exactly 180 degrees the opposite of A Lonely Man of Faith, where the two diatribes from 70 and 74, one against President Belkin and one against Vice President Rachman, which became part of the central documents of centrist polemics. Now, in 1970, YU had to become a secular campus, or else it was going to lose federal funds. You no longer could wake people up for minyan or require religious observance. There was debating floating around campus in that year whether YU should become secular like Brandeis, or it should even become co-ed and buy Fairleigh Dickinson's campus. Belkin was seriously entertaining some of those ideas. We don't have deaccession papers floating around yet, some future version of this will be photocopying those papers. Even the newspaper articles from the commentator were very oblique. They were not allowed to publish details of what was really being debated. Hold on, no questions until I finish them. At the Chag HaSmicha in 1970, Rav Soloveitchik gets up and does a diatribe against Belkin as having great hubris, that the raison d'etre of YU is about Torah, about the Mesorah, about building a halachic universe, and not about the secular world. There are various versions of it floating around. As far as I know, no complete version floating around of that speech. But the important thing, on one hand, is it created an anti-secular rhetoric, pro-Torah only. That's our reasoning. And the upshot of that was not to deal with the questions of how the Rav was received, was not, oh, let's all listen to the Rav, but then there was no Chag HaSmicha for the rest of the Rav's life at YU because they didn't want to give the Rav a floor again to get up and do anything like that. I mean, do not think that the fact that the Rav got up there and said this, that the whole world then said, oh, we've got to listen to the Rav. No, they then banned Chag HaSmicha for the next 15 years to make sure he doesn't do this. In the end, there was a compromise. YU did become secularized, but it did not become a Brandeis. But it was still being floated. It was still floating around, even into the late 70s, about what the future of YU was going to be when President Lam came into office. But in 74, the Rav took his own liberties, that when Vice President Rachman wanted to set up a Beit Din to free those women whose husbands wouldn't give a get, the Rav did an essay, gave a speech called Kabar O Malchut Shemayim, of which is available in its entirety on the web. It gets reprinted often, and for some reason all the centrists and all the blogs are forever quoting this speech as if it was the most important thing the Rav ever wrote. And in this thing it says, we are the Mesorah Talmud Torah community in which only Balei Mesorah can decide things. Any role of psychology, history, or sociology is not our method. And there became a converse to this statement. Therefore, anybody who uses psychology, history, or sociology is ipso facto conservative. Meaning, no longer was the line Torah min hashamayim, or driving to shul, or the considering the Torah shebaal peh as divine. It became no longer anything historically descriptive. It became an ideal definition. Anything psychological, historical, or sociological is ipso facto conservative.
It's hard to paper. Huh?
What?
It's hard to paper on legal philosophy. Yeah. Inside or outside.
Yeah. So that becomes the working definition. This essay was never officially published, but it played a greater role than Lonely Man of Faith did in centrism. Okay. I'll spare you on the other stuff. Spare you on going through my two articles in the Rav, and let any other questions on the Rav as a modern Orthodox figure.
What about just his reception today?
Today?
June 15th? Between Israel and America and the different Shivot and...
When that volume ever comes out from Van Leer, that from the Rav conference from 2003, you will see that Kibbutz Hadati is one reading, the Dakti Machadashim have another reading, the Americans have another one, and a lot of those cards were on the table there. There are many people who claim sole proprietary rights to the Rav, but he influenced many, many different groups in many different ways. There was even one paper on the influence of the Rav on Australian Jewry, which I walked half out of just because it was not... I should strike that. It's just because, you know, Australian Jewry is not on my major track, but the point is showing how it interfaced with their visions of Orthodoxy when they received Lonely Man of Faith. And then later the translation of Halachic Man. Okay, now we turn to Chabad as another form of modern Orthodoxy. Okay, where we usually associate Hasidus with the 18th and 19th century, Chabad went through a process of serious modernization in the 20th century that really separated it from the other Hasidic movements. Meaning already the 5th Lubavitch Rebbe, we're going to be doing the 5th and 6th quickly and then getting up to the 7th. The 5th Lubavitch Rebbe, Rav Shalom Dov Baer, who lived from 1860 to 1920, was already responsible for making Chabad different than the others by first founding the Lubavitch Yeshiva movement, making Hasidus more like Misnagdus. 2, he converted Hasidus from an oral to a written culture. Until that point, Chabad Torah was only available orally from a mashpia or from little pamphlets. He was now commissioning people to start publishing things in a systematic way, creating a library of Chabad books. And the books are going to come out looking like modern books. Among other things, Rav Shalom Dov Baer also visited Freud for a case of melancholy. He was exposed, meaning, so he actually was in at least some short-term therapy with Freud and was exposed to modern ideas of modern man and psychology and modern needs. Now, Shalom Dov Baer is called the Rambam of Hasidus in the fact that he reformulates and systematizes Chabad thought with less metaphysics and more psychology.
This is the 5th Rebbe.
Yes. So rather than Nefesh HaBamis as some sort of metaphysical entity, your animal soul, the Rebbe Rishab will formulate it as your vices, your hatred of other, your self-obsession, your self-aggrandizement, your melancholy. And that itself is a major reformulation right from the start. And the way that we prevail over our vices is to cultivate empathy. The Rebbe Rishab has a concept of an unconscious that is filled with greed and pride. Chassidus will make us truly human by being able to relate well to others, which if we only had our subconscious, it would just be an animal existence. So we're someplace between Tanya and Freud in terms of the reformulation. No one's written a good essay yet on Kunsh Sumayan, where he does all these writings. Rav Shalom Dov Baer says, everyone needs Chassidus. We have to bring Chassidus into the world. And the way he does it is he writes systematic tracts. Kunshus HaTfilah, Kunshus Avoda, Kunshus Eid Chaim, in which he puts it in systematic 20th century terms, saying that everyone has to experience God and taste the higher unity. He mandated, very clear spiritual guidance within the yeshiva. He reformulates a lot of the Kabbalah as God, as just simple terms of God's hidden kingship, his malchut, which comes down and is manifest as Elohim in the world. The Yevshem Chavaya, which is God's kingship that's hidden, and Elohim, which is in the world. Rav Shalom Baer was also aware of the differences what we're going through. So, actually it wasn't him, but one of his students said that when the Tsar was overthrown, we've lost our metaphor for kingship because we can't relate to kings anymore. I mean, there's an awareness when you read his writings that times are changing. But his son, Rav Yosef Yitzchak, who lived from 1880 to 1950, usually called the Rebbe Riatz, or the Friedeker Rebbe in Yiddish, meaning the previous Rebbe. left his son, took over this, and actually had a conscious plan of modernization. First of all, Friedrich Rebbe, or Rebbe Riatz, embraced the common man and the unlettered piety of simple Jews, rather than traditional Hasidus and Misnagdus that praise the elite. Here there's a praising of simple Jews, arguing that common people can be on a higher level than a yeshiva bachar, because the fever is burning stronger. He actually visited America in 1929, and there's an account called Beaker Chicago, where he really talks about how these Jews in Chicago, with their burning energy, can be up much higher than what was going on in Europe in yeshivot. That itself is a transvaluation that he's going to have throughout his writings. He will move to, when he does move to America, he puts out a book called Some Aspects of Chabad Hasidus, and he says Chabad Hasidus is for all modern Jews. Every Jew, male, female, young and old, educated or not, has a connection to God, Torah, and Israel. Very different than the establishment in Europe. Everyone could connect to the divine. He continues his father's approach of saying that one has to overcome one's vices, and Hasidus will do it. He criticizes the Mussar movement as teaching moral perfection but leaving you unconnected to God. And he writes about Hasidus as being concerned with a common person and seeing God in everything. He's in some ways influenced by Peretz and Zubna. He's already one of the founders of the Rebbe Riatz himself is one of the founders of Neo-Hasidism, in which God is in all things. Rebbe Riatz, the most important thing he's going to contribute to Jewish history is the invention of outreach. He invented Kiruv. The establishment in Europe tended to have statements, things like those people who are falling away are the heir of Rav, and it's good for the Jews. He now invents the idea that we have to do outreach to the unaffiliated, to the alienated. I mean, everyone's picked it up from him, because none of the traditional groups in Europe did outreach in any way to Jews. So when he was already in Russia, he was doing outreach to Bukharia and to Jews in Central Asia. When he came to New York, he founded outreach organizations, and he targeted specific groups like the farmers of Southern New Jersey, Jewish farmers of Southern New Jersey, the chicken farmers, and public school kids. He also targeted Moroccan Jewry. He was pro-labor. My own research has shown almost all the Lamed Vavnik stories go back to him or his followers.
Which story?
The Lamed Vavnik, the 36 hidden tzaddikim. Because even though it's in the Gemara that there are 36 hidden tzaddikim, the idea of the way the stories then work, in which you could be in some place in South Africa or Australia or in the middle of California or wherever you are, and this Jew who seems so far from the models of an Erlich HaYid in the old country could really reveal himself to be a true tzaddik, is ever present in the writings of him and in his court. That when you least expect it, the person who looks the least like the old country is going to reveal themselves to be the true tzaddik, the true righteous one in your community. He also wrote a history book called the Rebbe's Memoirs, translated the Rebbe's Memoirs, which is a Chabad account of history, which has been called by one scholar hagiography with footnotes. But the important thing, what it does do, is it shows that Chabad pre-existed the Baal Shem Tov. It shows that the hidden Lamed Vavniks of Europe used to meet in the forest, and they determined Chabad was going to be the true Hasidus, and that Lubavitch predates Mezibitz, and it's a whole history, that Lubavitchers take as serious history. It also describes how the Kofrim work under Shimon HaKofer and all Haskalah, the same way there's one Rebbe, there's a Rebbe for the Haskalah, and how Misnagdim are really getting secret orders that people don't know from these Kofrim. The Rebbe was also under the Rebbe's auspices, there was a quote-unquote the Cherson Geniza, which were hidden letters which came out and fabricated under the Rebbe, which prove all these points definitively. The other Hasidic groups do not accept these as authentic letters.
What are they called?
It's called the Cherson Geniza. They were published in Hatzon. Cherson is a city in Bessarabia. And they came out in Hatzonim in 1922-23. There's a whole literature on the veracity of them.
So it's like
the protocol to those of mine. No, it's there's a of how it's a internal tales of Chabad, and these were the documents that just got revealed to prove it. Now we come to the important point. His son-in-law took over Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who built on the thought of his predecessors. Now, much of Menachem Mendel's metaphysical thoughts has antecedents in the Rebbe Rishab, but he went in some very new directions. Yes?
What year are we talking about?
1950. First of all, Rav Menachem Mendel believes that Judaism changes in every generation, and his term is a continuous progressive revelation. Each age has more and more revealedness of God. Though our age may seem like an age of religious darkness, because it seems dark, we need greater religious light to overcome it. Therefore, our age is worthy of new Torah, new explanations, new customs. And where the old Hasidus reached through all the Svirot and all the Olamot, the light in our age has to come directly from Keser, directly from the highest level of divinity. So we get to bypass all the metaphysics because we have a higher revelation in our age.
Keser is Ainsof in their formulation,
right? It becomes the whole metaphysics gets pushed aside because now we have this direct connection. And we have to find Keser at the basic levels of our life, spiritual resolution, devotion, binding oneself to God. And Rav Menachem Mendel, as soon as he became Rebbe, starts talking about the modern era, that we're not godless moderns, but since we have progressive revelation and it's a new era, we have ever higher lights. The problem of modernity is not Haskalah, which is false, but materialism. If we can overcome materialism, we would come to the true ruchnias, the true spirituality, the true lighting ourselves up as human beings. So it's not about philosophy, it's about learning to reconnect ourselves beyond our desires and materialism. The Rebbe was in favor of miracles even before he became Rebbe. From 1932, he was talking about the importance of miracles in life. So where others wanted to be scientific, like Rav Soloveitchik, the Rebbe, despite his first degree in engineering from a polytechnic institute, he actually was a very big believer in miracles. and that therefore miracles show you that we don't just listen to science. Yes.
Miracles in terms of God's intervention.
Anti-Moksim in the Rebbe's sense, but the sense that are
through the course of history.
That's right, or the course of nature. So what the Rebbe does is he takes the term Nes Nistar from the Ramban and from others, hidden miracles, and he says hidden miracles in our age are overt revealed miracles, are Nes Nigla, and they're all messianic. So if you see something in history, in your life, a relapse, a remission from a sickness, where we would say it's a Nes Nistar, a hidden miracle, the Rebbe says it's a messianic Nes Nigla, a revealed miracle showing you God's higher lights within our life. And so our life is very charged now in America with seeing God's hand. And these are higher than the old country, because there you needed to see an explicit one that violated. But here we now see that that our everyday life is filled with the divine. The third element after the idea of directly reaching Keser and the continuous revelation and the miracles is the idea of essence, atzmos. And here essence is not used in any metaphysical sense. Essence, okay, so it's not essence in the medieval sense. Atzmos means any form of commitment, submission, or connection. Anything that touches the self is atzmos. So if you have a moment where you have that peak moment, that connection to God, or feeling something in your heart, that's reaching the true essence of everything. That's truly touching atzmos. That's truly reaching the highest level of divinity. So the Rebbe has collapsed the Kabbalistic hierarchy, told you that things in your daily life are miraculous, and then said whenever you experience God, you're really experiencing the highest levels. There's no longer a hierarchy of saying, yes, you've just started and there's a long way to go. No, any moment is the deepest level. So the example the Rebbe gives is saying Moda Ani in the morning. Because you do that as soon as you wake up in the morning. It's an immediate moment of connecting to God. So Moda Ani can be higher than Torah and Tefillah. And Moda Ani you can still do while in the bed, before Negel Vasser. It doesn't mention God's name. Showing you that moment of connection is really what counts, not the formal systems of Torah, mitzvahs, metaphysics, or anything else. It's that connecting. Now, how does that play itself out? Connection is going to be what he specialized in. Therefore, he'd give you a penny and then later a dollar for tzedakah. That would be a moment of dedication and commitment. That would be a moment of reaching atzmos. And that really fits in with a lot of America. Step right up and make a moment of commitment. American religion is very much about affirming the moment. And the Rebbe created all forms of whether it's going to be, you know, putting on tefillin or lulav etrog or giving out the pennies and dollars. It's that moment of connection is much higher than any formal, because I'm probably going to get to it in a minute or two, is much higher than any formal connection through the system, through halacha, through anything that's stated out there. And he says you find this essence in all forms of dedication. All Rebbes are the essence of Hasidus, because if you've become dedicated through the Rebbe, you've now reached the essence of Hasidus. And in all of this, it's about connecting to the divine. Mitzvah, as already the Derech Mitzvah Secha, the third Chabad Rebbe said, comes from the root of tzavta, associating yourself with God. Mitzvot are about reaching that association, and in the Rebbe's sense, it becomes that moment of dedication. So giving you a tzedakah box to put a penny in, giving machine matzahs to out to people, random people, going to reform summer camps and getting them to put on tefillin is all reaching atzmus. It's all part of the same perspective. And in this, he's going to quote his father-in-law, saying that in America, what counts is not whether things are forbidden or not. It's about whether you're are you maintaining a connection or not. So therefore, what's important is going beyond the letter of the law. So the person who's keeping the halacha, but it doesn't have moments of connection, is not as good as the person who can have that peak moment by that moment of connection. He says even intellectual Torah study only leads to snobbery and doesn't lead to a closeness to God. And this is going to be very unlike Rav Soloveitchik, who's going to talk about the peak Torah study. Here it's all about, here it's not cognitive and existential, it's about volition. Step right up and make this act of affirming what you believe in. What is Rosh Hashanah about? Rosh Hashanah is about rededication, just like the Moda Ani prayer. So even if you go to shul once a year, it's a moment of rededication. It's not about tshuva, it's not about introspection, it's about that moment of dedication. So the question is not, are you allowed to, but are you connecting within this? So, for example, Lamatet Melachot, the 39 forbidden categories of work on Shabbos. Here the question is, are they helping you lead a more connected life? And he says there are four approaches that one has to overcome when you think about Shabbos in America. The first person in America, even though they're keeping the Shabbos, never leaves the exile of the week, so they're not gaining anything. They spend Shabbos thinking about the week. And it's always thinking about their work. The second person leaves their work, but spends all their time thinking about halachic questions, about what they can do or what they can't do, so it also doesn't touch their soul. The third person may want it to touch their soul, but they want it to touch their soul like it was in Europe. And the Rebbe says on this one, and this is really what makes the Rebbe so modern, your Rebbe lived in a shack, wore the same shirt for 50 years, couldn't read a newspaper. You don't live that life anymore. We don't look back. He repeats that in many forms, in many of the sikhas. Your grandfather lived in a shack, in poverty, with sickness, illiterate, without anything. We have continuous progressive development. We have ever greater expansiveness. And therefore, your Shabbos is to be ever greater expansive. And the fourth group are those who do the mitzvah of Shabbos with joy, who truly experience the connection to God through Chabad. The Rebbe is one of the few mid-20th century thinkers that criticized materialism, modernity, and thought of human life as a vanity fair that one has to survive. The Rebbe believed we had to go beyond all our human condition of our desires, our shtus, our neurosis, our egoism, and find those moments of connection. And all of our descents and falling and confusion is only because of the material world. But when we have that connection, we're rededicated. It's not fundamentally part of the modern world the way it is in Lonely Man of Faith. For the Rebbe's, no, that moment of connection will give you a guiding path. He sees that in all of his biblical exegesis, which I'm not going to go into. Avraham, Yosef, everyone was about how to lead a meaningful life. Now to some specifics. The Rebbe is responsible for most of the wedding Torah that's out there. The Rebbe's wedding Torah was taken by many ordinary pulpit rabbis, So whenever you hear these wedding homilies, because in Eastern Europe, you know, wedding homilies were, you know, so that the guy can now, you know, whatever, you know, have a yeshiva das or whatever they are. But now the wedding Torah is about loyalty, dedication, commitment to each spouse to each other. Were written by the Rebbe, and they get quoted by everyone. So whenever you hear these Torahs, whether you heard it through Chief Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, or you heard it through some young Israel rabbi, or you heard it through Shlomo Riskin, whom a lot of his drushes come from the Rebbe's drushes, or you heard it through Shlomo Karbach, wedding Torahs were created by the Rebbe, but the need for loyalty, dedication, devotion. He also created drushes on education, that you need not just an intellectual education, but a spiritual education. And therefore everyone in America needs a spiritual education. And he started with Carter, but really succeeded with Reagan, of now having Education Day, in which Americans should seek the spiritual education. And as a side point, the Rebbe said, we've got to teach this Torah to all the non-Jews of America. They are also now in our high modern messianic age, part of God's kingdom. And the Rebbe said, creating a good marriage is miraculous and it's messianic. Creating an educating community is miraculous and messianic. And the phrase that he used from his father-in-law, but he used it quite a bit, is the phrase, Uferatzta mayanos hachutza, one should disseminate the wellsprings far afield. Disseminate, you should bring chassidus into every discussion and everything in the public sphere. Wellsprings, what counts is like a well, not an ocean. It's the quality, not the quantity. And far afield, every location in the world. Got to have some connection. The Rebbe rejected the term Kirov and called it Avas Yisrael, because who really knows who's closer to God? Okay, that wasn't invented by Shlomo Karbach, that was the Rebbe, because we can't really know who's close and who's not. He also now says that in the old days, Chassidus was only taught by the elite who really understood things. Now everyone can teach Chassidus, so anyone can be a shliach. Okay, that has both good and positive, both good and negative points, but anybody can be a shliach. Anyone can go out there. Oh, even the commonest person who, no matter how what your learning level is, you can go out and bring Chassidus to the world. Unlike in Europe. Some of his specific advice is, for example, Jews who are drafted into the army. It's enough if you say Shema and put on tefillin once a day. That's all we can expect you to do to keep your moment of connection every day. Unlike, for example, if you look at the Chafetz Chaim's book on what Jews should do when they're drafted into the army, and the Chafetz Chaim is telling you, well, he'll let you daven Marav after Chatzos, and, you know, also the very technical, you know, leniencies. Here it becomes, if you could have one moment, say the Shema, put on tefillin once a day, and if you can, avoid, you know, chazer, that's all expected. We'll worry about the rest of the mitzvot when you're out of the army. The Rebbe started outreach to people that nobody ever did outreach with. He did outreach in nursing homes with the elderly. He did outreach to the mentally challenged in institutions. He did outreach in prisons. He did outreach to the army. Now the actual how the outreach proceeded. From 1950 to 1960, he was involved in the Hasidic world, building youth programs, summer camps. From 60 to 70, he opened Chabad houses all over America. The first real important one was the one in California. They started reaching out to the Baal Tshuva movement in 64, and they assumed responsibility and set up programs for people who had been in cults and for deprogramming. Between 70 and 80, the Rebbe started a 10-point mitzvah campaign to say that this is the basics that we have to bring to everybody, and started making emissaries all over the world, and he started having the long receiving rhymes to give out a dollar rather than having any one-on-one time with people. He also turned to telecommunications and advertising during that decade. Between 80 and 90, the outreach increased to now having a youth campaign, a woman's campaign, all sorts of Gentile campaign. And this is not my topic for today, but a lot of the Rebbe will say things that nobody said before. For example, how American Gentiles are true worshippers of God, and now in the Messianic era, they're going to all be redeemed. He talks about, on women's issues, how women really receive the Torah before men, and a lot of what they do is really greater than what men do. And it was not apologetics like it is in a lot of the yeshivish works. He really believed that a lot of the home, the family, the connection, the dedication was the real connection. Hold on. Now, some examples of this. Oh, let me just get the handout that I just printed out. The effects of a Jewish woman to serve as catalyst for the redemption have historical precedence. In the Egyptian exile, it was Miriam who relayed the prophecy that a redeemer would emerge. And he has lots of these sort of statements. He talks a lot about technology. A car is a complicated machine, yet its tremendous power is derived from a single spark that sets the engine in motion. Nevertheless, it is not good for the motor if the starter's sparking action is often too low. And then he talks about how American Jews, sometimes their starter is too low, and they need that great moment of connection to get them going. Another one about the role of the artist, that the artist has to detach himself from superficial appearances and has to be gifted, whether in sculpture, painting, and whatever endeavor, to truly understand it in its vital form. And that all artists should then use their artistic talent to reflect Torah and mitzvot. The Rebbe is going to be very into encouraging poets, artists, sculptors. Some of you may know the artist Lifshitz, who is close to the Rebbe, to use their artistic talents. Here's the sort of speech that you just look at and you're not sure what to do with. In 1991, there was the riots in Crown Heights. And Mayor Dinkins visited the Rebbe and wanted to make peace between the Jews and the blacks. The Rebbe answered, "Don't say two people, one people under one government and one God. The unity of Jews and blacks permits no diversity. A unity between Jews and blacks will permit no diversity. All diversity is a limited concept. Unity, if it has diversity, is only surface deep. By contrast, a unity that recognizes diversity can thrive. Thus, unity and diversity implies a shared acceptance of inner truth. Common principles and ideals have the power to bring together American people with different abilities. So interdependence is a desirable facet of American life. More can be accomplished when people with varied gifts pull together." So his idea of diversity is not Jew or non-Jew or one group versus another, but we're all part of this rainbow of different people out there with different gifts serving God. Whatever the political merits of that was. But it's a speech showing you what he's embracing. Okay. Yes.
Looking at contemporary theorists of American religion, you get the sense that there's this idea of we have morals, but then again, hey, the morals only apply to public figures, and they just reconfirm that we're really doing okay. Do you get that sense from Nareda at
all? No. He thought everyone has to be leading a moral life. That's part of the attraction of his message.
No, but he's addressing you as you are. He's saying, Dmitri Saliba, you want to be a boxer, that's great, but you got to be Makari Shem Shimon.
That's right. Boxers, artists, no matter what you're doing, you can use it to sanctify God. It's not going to be, we're going to make you over into a Ben Torah. No, we're going to make you over into a meaningful life. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Do you explain further this moment of connection, what that means? Like, is it this eternal moment where we're trying to escape history?
No,
Is it romantic? Is it...
It's that volitional moment when you now say, I want to dedicate myself to God, Chassidus, finding meaning to your marriage, to your kids, to whatever it is. That dedication moment, that moment of connection is his root metaphor that he uses.
So, the idea that we're supposed to live in that moment?
No, we can't live in that moment, is we need those moments to get us through. Our life is about creating those moments. So it's clearly a philosophy, not of the consistency, the halachic universe every day. It's that moment of finding your spouse and knowing this is the right one. It's knowing the right ideal of how you want to educate your kids. It's a vision for America. It's that moment of putting on tefillin for the first time in your life. It's that moment of the Rosh Hashanah where you know it's completely different than the way you live the rest of the year. It's those peak moments.
So it's intuitive more, just like this inner revelation? It comes from within?
It comes, I don't even know, from within. It's that moment of step right up and say this is where you want to be, of knowing how you want to focus your life.
Does he derive this from any type of tradition within Kabbalistic?
Well, that was the point. He started with the fifth Rebbe's idea of taking the metaphysics out and making it an overcoming your negative drives and making this worldly. His father-in-law's approach is about the common man. Now he takes it a step further and says it's that commitment to want to overcome a meaningless existence, that committed moment to say, I want to do something valuable in life, that's what counts.
So he's not working within the system, he's skipping the system and coming up with it and just like responding to today's issues.
It's a way of responding, and it's a very American, and that's the attraction. It's that step right up and be born again, or rededicate yourself, or refind yourself right now.
So is there any continuity between that and the past Kabbalistic hierarchy?
Very little. Very little. Yes?
When we do an end run around the metaphysics of Kabbalah, what do we think of the people who came before us? What do we think of the hierarchy? Do we think we transcended it?
We are now in a higher age. There's a messianic. We live in a messianic age, and that's what I'm going to get to now.
What's the source of everything?
Okay. He's going to tell lots of the drushes, marriage is the most important event in the life of a man or a woman. I mean, he's going to go that moment that you know you want to get engaged. He's going to keep harping back to those moments. And that's what Hanukkah is about. That's what Rosh Hashanah is about. That's what Shmatz is about. It's about that moment of connection. Right. Yes?
Do we have the ability to retrieve the moments we've already passed?
I mean, is it about memory?
Yeah.
No. It's about continuous connection.
So what would
for creating peak moments.
So what's the significance of like the Seder
perhaps? The Seder will be that moment of experiencing the same way the Jews had miracles when they came out from Egypt, is having that sense of the miracles in our own life and then rededicating ourselves to go forward with it.
So it's nothing to do with your two at the time.
Right. Right. It's not about this abstraction. It's not about the books behind it. Rosh Hashanah is not tshuva, repentance, or penance. It's about that moment of that peak moment of this is what it's about. Hanukkah is not, there is no real Chashmonayim, nor is it about Torah Shabbat Peh or anything. Hanukkah is the light, having enough light to keep us going.
So it's eternal, not historical.
It's not even eternal. There's no eternal. It's not temporal. It's that moment of commitment. Yes?
knowing about all the different varieties of Breslov and all the complexities there, but also knowing Rav Nachman's Tzitzkakos and Nefesh, I see it as sort of like a parallel to the Rebbe, in the sense that it's dealing with you as you are, and it's saying, you know, we're breaking down the hierarchy, you're good the way you are, Rav Nachman, I can see him saying, you know, you're a boxer, so say this simple meditation and, you know, pray to God that you'll punch the other guy.
Yeah, I'm using Chabad as an example. I mean, there is a strong Neo-Breslov in the world. There are different types.
So
different.
Why did Neo-Breslov catch on Israel and Chabad in America to generalize, you know, knowing that there's a big Chabad in Tzvat and knowing that there was a Breslov?
Why did Chabad catch on in America?
Yeah, and
the president,
why not
Rebbe, a living Rebbe who's spending day and night doing this and inspiring people to go out there and bring this forward. It's not something you have to go in and, you know, meet Rav Schick in Brooklyn. This is going out there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And in Eretz Yisrael, why did Breslov seem to do better?
That's a separate thing that I'm not going to go into, because that has less to do with modern Orthodoxy and more with issues there. Next, the messianism. Already from the death of the sixth Rebbe in 50 and 51, the drushes after the death, the Rebbe already talked about how we still have to bind ourselves to the sixth Rebbe, that while the sixth Rebbe was alive, he was only visible in the world and obscure in the world to come. Now the sixth Rebbe is visible in the world to come, but obscure here, and you still have to connect to him. We've got to bind ourselves to his grave and have pictures of his grave. We have to await his resurrection. We have to have beeswax candles, which are an acronym of resurrection, because we're waiting for the sixth Rebbe to come back. We should prostrate ourselves before his picture. That's not new stuff from the 90s. That was there right from the 50s. The fact that there's a lot of other modern Orthodox that only discovered in the 90s doesn't mean it wasn't there already from the 50s, because that's what Hasidus was. He in the 1950s, the Rebbe already talked about this very little difference between life and death, and that the dead are completely with us, and that the sixth Rebbe is still running things and is still our guidance. He says, in 1951, he gave a drasha, if the sixth Rebbe died, why did the sixth Rebbe die if he could perform miracles, especially since he knew the Messiah was coming very soon? And he answered, is that now that he's dead, he's more bound to the world, because he doesn't have to worry about physicality. Okay, so those are not new things from the 90s. Those were right there from the 1950s. And that's part of the problem of some other groups that either think that messianism is either not, you don't believe in it, or it's apocalyptic. American Jewry really put away a lot of the Eastern European forms of messianism that were passive, neutralized, somewhat ironic, but ever there. I mean, whatever there is, there was a certain negative influence, whether Gershon Sholem also, that really didn't recognize the passive messianism of Eastern Europe. You know, the Messiah is coming tomorrow, but in the meantime, I thought to plan Shabbos. That was really part of Eastern European Jewry, that it wasn't a choice between Shabtai Tzvi or Reform Judaism, the way Sholem presented it. No, Eastern Europe had this continuous messianism is around the corner at every point. The fact that it's also, besides being passive, also being very ironic. And the Rebbe will, already from the 50s, called finding meaning in our lives, healing our lives, energy to face the new day, educating our children, forging good marriages. He called all of them messianic. Anything that's going to now redeem the world is messianic in his language. All forms of hope and commitment are messianic. So where others use the phrases like wonders of nature, hope for a better tomorrow, commitment to the family. The Rebbe used the phrase messianic. And already from 1951, the Rebbe had said all sevens are messianic. Now we come to the 1990s. This is also part of the modernity. In the 1990s, WABC had a ad campaign called Expect a Miracle. Okay, late 80s and 90s, for those who read Wuthnow, was already a big time for the New Age, and it was the age of angels, the age of miracles. The Rebbe's miracle language really caught on during that era. So whatever ABC meant when it said expect the miracle, for those followers, expect the miracle was all American in 1990. Furthermore, the Rebbe applied messianism to the events of the world. Six-Day War, the Gulf War, the fall of communism, they're all messianic. That's also very modern. There's a great book, which I didn't assign, by Paul Boyer, B-O-Y-E-R, called When Time Shall Be No More, Prophetic Belief in Modern American Culture. Showing how much of America, how most evangelicals believe in a messianic history, and when they read the paper every day, they see it in a messianic terms. But beyond that, for most Americans and most who follow this evangelical thinking, messianism is their only means of making sense of the paper. It's a puzzle to be figured out. If you understand the world in biblical terms, then your goal is to figure out how the paper plays into the biblical terms. That, too, is all American, and the Rebbe's messianism about the Gulf War, the fall of communism, you know, play well in the Left Behind series that now is bestsellers in America. Also all American, but it's not the modernity of Kierkegaard. It's the modernity of evangelical for them, if they call it premillennial dispensationalism, meaning their millennialism. The Rebbe's approach fits in well. Now, for example, Ronald Reagan, contemporary of the Rebbe's, said Russia and Gorbachev are the Antichrist, and then Reagan was expecting the war of Gog and Magog, bringing the second coming within his own lifetime. Meaning, that's really all American, and that's the side that the Rebbe is really very American, that centrists have a very hard time understanding, clustered here in the East Coast, about how much of that this is American way of thinking. But it's also showing how ironic this way it works. Reagan, 2 years later, was in Moscow treating Gorbachev as an ordinary person, going out, for coffee with him. What happened between Gorbachev being Antichrist and being a Gog and Magog, and then being an ordinary person, there's this continuous irony in which you can forever, this American millenarianism is always indeterminate, in that you can forever keep receding it and rereading it every day, because you know the Bible's true, and you know that the paper's got to be playing it out, but it doesn't have to be fixed. And that was exactly the way the Rebbe works. So, for example, after 9/11, the books that sold out in America were ones that explained how 9/11 was Gog and Magog. The Rebbe fits in perfectly to that American approach. Okay, yes, do you want to ask something?
Two things. First of all, if you're sitting in New York, it makes sense to be a centrist, I think. And if you're going,
I don't know who's more sensible and who's not, but
no, but I'm not to make a value judgment, but how did the Rebbe get the sense of what was going on outside of New York, and how did the Rebbe, whereas we might have thought this is what the world is doing because this is what the East Coast elite is doing, That's A. And the second question is, what does it mean to have a messiness that doesn't create a liminal space, that doesn't create a, you know, where it's a constantly simmering messiness,
okay,
whether in evangelicalism or whether in...
So the first question, if his ear was to the ground of the way America really worked in a way... That in a way that he really did listen, even the people who were just coming in, is that you once you then say you have to understand the daily newspaper and you have to find meaning in it, you're not going to find meaning in the daily newspaper through Habermas. You're going to do it through the Bible, and that's going to be millenarianism. The fact that it's forever indeterminate and pushed off is a quality which I'm not going to include. It's all... pre-dispensational, meaning the biblical events are being played out in pre-messianic times. You don't have to wait for that grand moment for Eliyahu HaNavi to show up or Gabriel to show up. No, there's a whole ordinary, an ordinary time process. And that really did catch on. Why it caught on was not just evangelical, it was also the way many Americans dealt with World War II, the atomic bomb, and changes of the 50s and 60s, is that since there are these new events, you have to say, you have to incorporate them, and where centrists explain the new events in what in some form of, you know, Max Weber, you know, rupture and now modernity, more Americans did it in this pre-dispensational way. Okay, so Paul Boyer's book is very good on this.
What's his book?
When Time Shall Be No More.
Okay.
Let's go on. How has the Rebbe modern? Now, when you read the letters to artists like Elie Wiesel and Chaim Grada, the Rebbe tells them not to waste their time talking about the breakdown of modernity and people not doing things or feeling alienated. He asks everyone to write books about Torah and Mitzvot. So in some sense, you smile, because it's very unlike the Rav, who appreciated the complexity of the modern condition shown in Grada. The Rebbe says, no, you should be using your artistic talents to show meaning to everybody.
He's like, what's it called? Yisharim Tehillah.
What?
Yisharim Tehillah. It's like...
Yeah, it's very didactic. The Rebbe did, however, believe in fighting the Vanity Fair of materialism in America. He mentions Buber in his letters, and he says that where Buber speaks about an eclipse of God, and that where Buber speaks about we have to find God now in our encounters with other people... The Rebbe says there's no eclipse of God. Buber's wrong. There's a continuous progressive revelation, and we have ever greater connection in the modern age. Because in the old country, you needed a whole package. Now those peak moments is really what counts. And those peak moments are a commitment, a deed, allowing you to see meaning in life. So where the fifth Rebbe entered modernity by psychologizing and building yeshiva, the sixth Rebbe through reaching to the common Jew, the seventh Rebbe was about dealing with assimilation and disinterest by reconnecting. And the one that now all the pulpit rabbis quote, which was said by the sixth Rebbe, but the seventh Rebbe used it a lot. Now in America, we no longer worry about the four sons because they come to the Seder. The one we have to worry about is the fifth son who doesn't even know how to come to the Seder. How do we connect to that fifth son who doesn't know to be there? That's really where he's modern. It's about having some sense of what the fifth son needs, and that moment of step right up and find commitment, or step right up and find marriage, education, and meaning in life. And that's the Rebbe's approach. So if we go back to our typology we've been using, what did Chabad do for Bible study and study in general? Chabad is going to really create a completely self-contained Chabad library. of Chabad, every Chabad stories, Chabad Bible, Chabad Sichas. And so in that sense, it's not going to really be like the others. Two, its vision of continuity, it's not going to be continuous with Europe. It's going to be continuous with its own historic account of Europe, in which Lubavitch is greater than the Baal Shem Tov. It's going to be continuous with its own vision, which was already about the projecting that the interest in the common man and America started already in the 18th century. The laity, there's going to be a great emphasis that the laity can be greater than the elite. The common person, we don't know who's closest to God. That's one of the biggest changes of why it makes it modern. The issues it's concerned with is, besides materialism and assimilation, marketing. Chabad will be the best marketers for all these decades. I mean, now everyone's competing. But marketing was really where it was at for them, of how they were reaching out. What a modern rabbi has to be, not someone with a BA or a doctorate, but someone who can do shlichus, who can build from nothing. And sometimes you should look, there's a book by Hanna Pekarsky called The Shlichus Manual, which tells you how to be a shliach, how to build, make a newsletter, how to go out and start a nursery school, how to start
making recipes for 300.
That's right. It's a great volume. But that's what a modern rabbi needs to be able to go into a town and set up shop. And that's very different than any of our other models of what a modern rabbi has to be. But it's clearly a modern, you know, how to bake for 300 and how to get into the media.
How to write thank you notes. For money.
That's right. I mean, what's more important for being modern? Having read Kierkegaard and knowing how to write a thank you note and ask for money. Who will go further in the rabbit hole? In terms of philosophy, they're really not interested in philosophy. Social factors, there's going to be that millenarianism within Chabad. Education is going to be one of their weak points. For as much as they talk about it, they're not good at setting up systematic schools. And they will let, they care more about the moments of connection. They will bar mitzvah kids without any background. So as a conservative rabbi was complaining to me, they'll let a kid come the week before his bar mitzvah and do a bar mitzvah with absolutely no requirements that he even reads Hebrew or knows anything. Just no commitments. Just you want to do it, they'll do it. They have no educational requirements. So as much as they talk education, that's not really their strong point. Their strong point is touching people's lives. Yes?
Can we talk about fundraising for a minute and money? Like, what about the idea of a shliach not only building a community but also maintaining a middle-class lifestyle? And how much of this accommodationism is, well, we bypass the metaphysics, we're going to connect one time, and how much...
Okay. There are two elements here. One is, since the goal is to teach you how to have a meaningful life, I don't know if you watched the Chabad telethon. They had a scene there of teaching you how to use chargers under your dinner plates, to how to set an elegant table. But the point is they want to show you, they want to take you, what Peter Berger in his book Far Glory calls, they're going to help you get your act together. And therefore, act together, they're going to teach you even basic things about a home. If you grew up without manners, they're going to even teach you. Not only will they write thank you notes, there are some shlichim that will even teach you how to write thank you notes and be a mensch. And that's what they're more concerned with than actually teaching you anything that you can make a Birchas HaTorah on. The other point is they're very protean. They're willing to go anywhere and deal with any moment of connection, and they're told not to ask the questions. They're not being pragmatic as much as they really do believe. They really are told not to ask those questions in life.
Okay.
Yes.
Do you think that they're looking outward ultimately is causing their educational demise in terms of their own infrastructure, in terms of their own organization? They're too busy teaching, you know, Hebrew to Russians and not a serious, honest,
yes,
old school.
Okay, class. So the answer is in the 19... As of the 1970s, their teachers were all still yeshivish litvaks. I mean, Rav Gussman, you know, taught in Crown Heights originally. I mean, they knew to import yeshiva products for the yeshivas. I think the decision was not just the diffusion, but it's now saying they're going to have their own teach, rather than saying, look, this is not what we do. There's a lot of very good Talmidei Chachamim out there. We'll have them teach our community. So I think that was already a decision back in the 70s to not to replace the litvaks with other ones, but to use their own. But I do think they are becoming diffused, and I think they might actually, as the decades go on, we may see them be very different because they're going to be so cut off from their original Lithuanian roots. Yes?
How do we relate to people who are Baruch Bar Chabad, or people like Rav Gabriel Tziner, who want to be within the Machane, want to be Machabre Svarim within the Machane Acharedes, but still maintain this connection to whatever they think is special about Lubavitch? Do we relate to them that they're just people who never caught up with the Fifth Rebbe's revolution, and they're sort of behind the times? They have, you know, a love-hate relationship with it. Like, what's with those people? Because there's a lot of them.
How do we relate to them? I mean, I'm not sure. Are you asking me a evaluative question? I mean,
no. What's their deal? Where do they come from? How does someone live in?
Maybe the answer. Okay. So first of all, the Friedrich Rebbe still had a lot of very learned students, and the old timers were all very learned. And a lot of people have actually are learned and want to write Sfarim and want to be there, but they're not the trend.
Those will always be holdovers from the people finishing shots every year.
Yes, like telling me it's a centrist that has a soul. You know, that doesn't, you know, these things occur. So the answer is, yeah, they're, of course they're, we should appreciate it. I'm not sure what the question is, but they're not the mainstream.
But there's also a crossover. They will be Makari people in Satmar, the Chabad.
Yeah.
And those people will dress like Ungarishers and stay in that community.
That's right.
They'll have another shul.
Right.
So are they getting like...
Well, that's a whole question because they're not on our modern side, because that's a whole breakdown. It's about Satmar's breaking down and looking every which way to Lubavitch, to Ger, to everything.
Because they don't have tuxedos since Riviera.
Right. That's his own story, but that's not modern. That's clearly in the Haredi camp by all definitions. Here, I mean, I'm saying they're clearly not coming into the modern elements here. Okay, you'll get this stuff out. Let me now actually do a little experiment before we go on to our last topic, is in terms of, let's go back to open orthodoxy for a minute, now that we've done Chabad and engaged Yeshivish. Yeah. Okay. Back to open orthodoxy now that we've done engaged Yeshivish and Chabad. For whatever busyness, I have actually been out, whatever, 7 times scholar in residence since Purim, 5 of them in open orthodox congregations. And the one thing I have learned in just the last few weeks is that all of these rabbis spend all their time doing kiruv, doing outreach. They really are they're not philosophic, that as much as as much as the New York polemics between centrism and open orthodoxy are about philosophy or sociology or halacha, in real terms, out there in the field, the definition of open orthodoxy is someone willing to take a congregation of entirely non-from congregants and do outreach, or to take a dying inner-city congregation and to actually rebuild it from scratch by bringing in everybody. meaning actually going door to door and bringing in unaffiliated. So what does that mean? They're going out and speaking language of offering spirituality, talking high tech to the techies, bringing in about commitment, quoting over drushes from the yeshiva world or from Chabad, and taking in people who have no Jewish education, who clearly in 2005 send their kids to public school, and building communities based on fellowship and trust, not leadership and loyalty. And they're getting up there and leading services in which they go back to announce the pages, every two pages, and using prayer books that have transliteration. Now, one of the local conservative rabbis here in New Jersey told me he's against, and so is almost his entire movement, using transliterations, because that means you're creating a non-learned laity. Now, not analyzing what does that mean, that's its own interesting statement, but here we now have these rabbis going out there knowing that their congregations need continuous page announcements. They have no idea even the order of the service. Doing outreach to public schools, to the elderly, to people who are just unaffiliated, working together with other non-denominations and thinking of themselves non-denominationally the way Chabad does. They say we're just Jews. A lot of these congregations are also just saying that. They are reaching out to Russians, to assimilated, to mixed marriages, and bringing them into the congregations. And that's a lot of what Open Orthodoxy is doing out in America. So let's compare that a moment, and that's why I'm bringing this up, not to return to it, but to compare now engaged yeshivish to Chabad to Open Orthodoxy actually out there in the field. The one thing they all have in common is they're going to bring you home to a Shabbos table, and they're going to show you how wonderful it is, a Shabbos table is, and how wonderful Shabbos and mitzvahs are. But where they differ, which is not Datim HaChadashim or centrism or other approaches, but what they differ is where engaged yeshivish speaks the language of truth. We are now going to explain to you why the truth, the blueprint of the universe, or how you can now believe. And where engaged yeshivish speaks the language of finding meaning in life, because knowing that there's a higher game plan behind everything. Chabad wants you to find meaning in the moment. It's not the meaning of that there's a deeper game plan, but the meaning is right now how you can find connection right here, right now. While these Open Orthodox groups are now using the language of, some of them are using the Chabad language of meaning, but they're using the language of fellowship, trust, enjoyment, spirituality, which is a different language than the other two. They're all out there doing outreach, but the languages are different. Okay. That's why I came back to that, to understand, to see those different languages. Meaning where Chabadnik would say it's messianic to have a good marriage, or we're now going to find that meaning in life in that moment of commitment. The Open Orthodox is going to say, no, let's have fellowship and togetherness and let's all share the journey. And the engaged yeshivish will then say, we are now offering you the truth, or we're going to show you where there's a deeper meaning in life. Yes?
What's going on in terms of specific communities where Open Orthodoxy and Holy Day is...
I don't want to do a specific. I'm not dealing with specific. That we can turn if you want. I don't know. It's just late. We'll come back to that. Okay. Any questions on Chabad? Because I thought that was important to just show you the differences of the languages.
How are they not modern?
How are they?
Not modern.
They are not modern in... That's term, what does it mean, not modern? They're not modern in that they do not accept secular education, which is a big sign for some of the other groups. But once again, a lot of America's not. I mean, or they don't accept secular education above the elementary school level, or a 10th grade level, or whatever the cutoff point is. They are not modern is because they really don't acknowledge they don't remake Talmud Torah, and that almost all the other groups have a clear vision of Talmud Torah and modernity. Chabad, since it's least Talmud Torah and more people oriented, that in that sense they're not giving you the Talmud Torah. They're not modernists because that they are God intoxicated. And they really are spiritual in the sense of they're not going to talk about breakdown or difference or what. They're going to always use that language as if God is there. They are not modern in that they don't share a lot of the questions of modern issues. The things that came up in most of the other groups, whether it's in Israel, Tzava, or the government, or modern orthodoxy, it was suburbia, or centrism, it was entering med school, law school, politics. They don't have any of those agendas that they deal with. You're not going to have Chabad medical ethics. In some sense, they're just going to, you know, right? So, but that becomes a very funny point, and that meaning... It becomes the point that, on one hand, Chabad's biggest influence in America right now is in technically the reform and conservative movements, and they've almost single-handedly brought back tefillin wearing in the reform movement. So in some sense, they're entering a symbiotic relationship with the other movements. So therefore, people will always look elsewhere. Chabad, for most of the demographics, are not the sole source of everyone's life. So there's a core group in Crown Heights that can be incredibly anti-modern and really belong on the Hasidic line that's not modern at all. But that's very different. I mean, different than the Chabad as a outward group. So if you want to compare, as you compare Liz Harris's Holy Days, which is trying to capture the non-modernism of the Crown Heights Hasidim, to Sue Fishkoff's capturing the going out there into America aspect. And even going out there in America, they're always in symbiosis with somebody else in order to really make this work. Okay.
In terms of the dress, were they all, in terms of going back to the old style dress, was that something that was always there? Or were they also influenced by Satmar going back to the traditional dress?
What do you mean?
Meaning the kapata.
Well, the ones out in...
The dark hat.
That's going back, they're influenced by Satmar. That's the going back.
Chabad?
Yeah. Chabad's and the rest of America only wear business suits.
But with glasses.
Yeah, but then we're talking about the ones that you can find in Brooklyn, on the other hand, have there's groups that have become gone the other way also. And that itself is interesting, how they're maintaining that huge spectrum. You know, how is the rapping funky glass Chabadnik, you know, connected to the Chabadnik in Borough Park? They're in different worlds. But right now, I don't think that's caught up with them.
Well, what about the fight over the sign by 7th the corner?
Yeah.
And the Tzva. Like, the more extreme... People are starting to come to grips with the more extreme...
The answer is that has to do more with the Messianism, but I think the actual spectrum of their practice and belief has yet to catch up with them.
I was going to say, I've met a lot of people who at least claim they don't go to doctors, they don't engage, and they really just believe in miracles.
Right.
So, I mean, and obviously some do, some don't. Like, is there a reason for that?
I think there's a lot of class elements that go into that also. I mean, they're clearly to really, for those who followed the New York Times series a few weeks ago on class, there are those elements really do play a role. You know, if you do not have wraparound health care, that all you could do is pay out of your pocket, that already your entire vision of what medical care is very different than those of us who have, plans that will pay for anything and everything to no limits. So it's very, very different how you form a religious worldview based on it.
Do they have any sense, specifically the older generation of Kabbalah, do they have any sense of how much has changed?
The older ones do. You can do some. There's definitely a good article to be written by interviewing some of the older ones who are going to remember the good old days.
In terms of philosophy as well?
Yeah. In my time, the students of the Friedrichs were still around, the older guys, and, you know, they didn't know what hit them.
Is there any movement to go back to the old ways within Chabad?
But that's already not the modern Orthodox group. That's already the groups that are, looking toward more towards Satmar, but knowing they have the stronger philosophy.
Can the lack of continuity in their tradition, create a group at extinction?
No, because I think they're creating a brand new consciousness.
But when you're talking about, bringing it to your kids and generation to generation, do they have, something substantial to give over, or is it...
Yeah, I mean, we also record that the answer is there's a group of modern Chabadniks. For example, Krinsky's own kid went to medical school. I mean, there's a group that's really coming to be, that's really raising their kids like the congregations of the Shlichim. I mean, they want their kids to have the lives like the lives of the Chabad houses. That's different than the group that really likes the Brooklyn lifestyle. There's a real, that is a real break that's there. And, for example, there was the people who work even putting out their books are incredibly well edited. Their books are now as well edited as the Engaged Yeshivish World's books. And people who, if you look at them, they're nice. They're edited. The English is nice. They're modern organization. Normal structure, normal punctuation. Wonderful works. Okay. Final point on Chabad is this. I mean, there'll be a conference in November at NYU on Chabad as a modern philosophy and as a modern movement, organized by Schiffman and Wolfson, and all of us have been invited to speak. You've heard parts of my paper that I'm going to be giving there tonight, the modern orthodoxy elements, but everybody's doing different elements within it, and it's going to produce a volume. I think they want all of our papers in by January. So that'll also be a nice reflective volume.
Okay. Rachel Allier's article, any thoughts?
No, because it doesn't deal with our topics.
Okay.
Yes, let's move on to my final topic. What time is it? What? Okay, let me finish the lesson for 20 minutes. I'll finish exactly at 10. Is Rav Amital. I'm doing Rav Amital for, among other reasons, because I'm not going to go back and do Rav Kook for two sessions, only because it's the last night. Two, because I've already discovered you don't read Hebrew as a group. Three, No, that's a mussar I don't mind getting out there, that people do not read modern Hebrew, and the fact that I can't give you a list of modern makomos in modern Hebrew. But Rav Avital's works have recently all come out in English within the last year, or almost all of them. And he gives you an example of another philosopher out there who's cutting against the grain in a very different way than others are. And to give you a summary before I start, back to my major points, Rav Avital was the co-Rosh Yeshiva with Rav Lichtenstein of Yeshivat Har Etzion. But Rav Avital had a philosophy that the yeshiva has to go out b'chol door v'dor and answer the needs of that generation. Now, what makes him interesting is he comes from a normal Haredi background, and he used to be a Ram in Yeshivat Hadarom with Rav Shach. He was friendly with Rav Shach. Rav Shach took the path he took and said, no, things shouldn't change. In fact, we should go back and keep things the way they used to be. And Rav Avital, on the other hand, said, no, in this generation, we have to found Hesder Yeshivot, because if not, the religion and Gemara learning will be alienated from the world of the army and state building. So one chose the path of building Hesder, and he and Rav Goldwicht from KBY are some of the founders of the Hesder movement. And Rav Shach went the opposite extreme. That's why I find him an interesting closure to giving you of, you know, how someone chooses a path. In terms of the laity, Rav Avital, like Mamlachti Dati, is incredibly liberal. But he will still hearken back to Europe by using the word Menschlichkeit. Now, Menschlichkeit was not a firm word in the old country or even in this country. Menschlichkeit was a way of saying you want to be non-ideological, religious or non-religious, communist, socialist, capitalist, Likud, labor, conservative, orthodox, reform. Menschlichkeit in Yiddishkeit was a way of saying Klal Yisrael has a unity. And what's interesting about Rav Avital is he uses that word Menschlichkeit and he uses the word Yiddishkeit in order to avoid ideology. And that's another reason why I want to close with him, because almost everyone we've been doing has been so ideologically driven since we left behind some of our traditionalists, like Chief Rabbi Adler in England was probably our last non ideologically driven figure. Rav Avital is also non-ideologically driven and seeks to say there's a common core to all of us. His modern issues are obviously the state, but also what does the state mean? And in this he's going to have a unique philosophy of, yes, it's messianic, like the Merkaz world, but no, there are no guarantees. There are backwards movements. And we have to accept the full realism of the anti-messianists. Once again, it's his non-ideological point of view. And I would recommend for those who do not know about Israeli ideology, there's a new book that came out it's been translated into English, Ehud Luz, Wrestling with Power, that gives you a summary of many of the ideological issues. For example, the issues between labor and Likud, between figures like Israel Eldad, who says we lived in the realm of ideology, versus Harkavy the general that said we had to live in a world of reality and trust generals.
Rufus?
What?
Rufus?
Ehud Luz. Rav Avital says we claim both. We live in an ideal universe and we want the grand ideals both of the state and of the messianism, but at the same time we trust the generals and we live a realistic life. and we have a lot of the labor Zionist vision from figures like Yair Savan, the Mapamnik, let alone with getting you to read that in Hebrew. And with that, Rav Amital believes that there's a common base that all Jews should see that sovereignty for Jews is a good thing, no matter what position you hold, religious, non-religious, messianic, non-messianic. Sovereignty for Jews should just be a good thing, period. Once again, a non-ideological position. His idea of a modern rabbi is to think in, as an individual, to think critically. And what makes him interesting also for me is his canon for all of his writings. As he says, he's a fourth grade secular education, but his canon for explaining natural ethics, embracing the laity, the modern state is good, is Maharal, Ramchal, the Gra, Reb Tzadok, a canon that I'm very comfortable with, that he's going to use it for all these purposes. So just to give you a quickie rundown, is Rav Amital survived as a Hungarian Jew. His family was all killed in the Holocaust. He came to Israel and continued learning, studied under Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, married Isser Zalman Meltzer's granddaughter, went to Yeshiva, became rabbi of Rehovot and Ram and Yeshivat HaDarom, and then was one of the founders of the Hesder movement. As another political life point before we get down to the philosophy, in 93 he founded the religious movement Meimad, which was a religious Zionist movement that was pro-peace, against the Merkaz Messianism, pro-individualism, republished pieces of Rav Hirschenson, was against religious coercion, and eventually he served as a minister without a portfolio between November 95 to July 96, and he inspires a lot of the figures out there like Avi Ravitsky or Rav Gilad and others. But it's not the same because they don't speak the way he does. Now let's talk about his views. First of all, he holds that there is a natural ethic within Judaism. There should be a natural intuition within Judaism of the morally right behavior that doesn't need any book learning or redemptive sacrificial act in order to gain it. We all have it within us. And in this, he's going to quote the Gaonim, who have a similar position. He'll quote the Rambam. He'll quote others, that we have a natural ethic. He'll bring proofs, like why was Ammon and Moab blamed that they didn't bring food to Israel when they left Egypt? How did they know they were supposed to do it? Because everybody has a natural ethic. We've got to know what's morally right. So you can't say the state does not take precedence over ethics. What if he openly addresses questions like what is it when what do we do when the Bible and rabbinics are not moral? He gives two answers. One, we should always find the moral interpretation, and he's open to quoting Rav Hirsch and others to find the most moral interpretation of the law. And the other thing is we follow the halacha, but don't let it affect our natural ethics. Meaning ethics have an independent value, even though we follow the law. So unlike Shaddal and other traditionalists, for whom wanted to remake the halacha to be ethical, he's going to say there are two tracks. Even if you're following the halacha, the morals remain independent. And there are two stories that are told about comparing Rav Amital to Rav Lichtenstein, the halachicist. One of them is, what do you do if you have to save a life of a Gentile on the Sabbath? Rav Aaron says he would do on a desert island in which Darche Shalom wouldn't apply because nobody would see it. And Rav Lichtenstein, as the story goes, says he would save the Gentile based on the universal ethical principle, but then have to do tshuva for violating the Sabbath. While Rav Amital says no, he would be acting out of natural morality to save the Gentile, so then the tshuva would not be needed. The other version, the other story told, is the question about do you eat pork or human flesh in an extenuating circumstance? Rav Aaron goes out of his way to show you that pork is a deraisa, while human flesh is only a derabanan, and you have to understand that. And Rav Aaron, you haven't even heard him, will usually go out of his way to then also point out that the truma is a much worse than chazir. So therefore, if you have a choice between eating pork or going to a place with a bad hashgach on truma, or you choose, you don't eat from the one that doesn't have truma taken. Rav Amital, on the other hand, paraphrasing the Dor Revi'i, Rav Glazer, a modernist who doesn't fit into any category, says we have a natural repulsion from eating human flesh, therefore the Torah didn't have to tell it to you. It's automatically assumed that you don't eat human flesh. So even though there's a halachic calculus that says that human flesh is less of a problem than pork, that's not the way we actually live our lives. Our moral sense is what guides us. His reading of the Rav Simlai from Makot is to the Taryag Mitzvot, and then what about all those later statements that says you have to walk humbly with God, the righteous should live by his faith? He takes us that to show that the ethics are just as important as Mitzvot. Very different than centrism. He asked, if these are more important than commandments, why are they not commanded? And he says, because these we have to do naturally through our own moral perfection. And in that we have to be like the patriarchs, the Avot. And we have to use them as our role models. We have to come to it as our own motivation, like the patriarchs came to it. That voluntarism and voluntary ethics are in many ways greater than things that are commanded. Voluntarism is greater than obedience. And he calls all this Menschlichkeit, and he sees this is the way of Judaism that's always been. He criticizes over-scrupulousness in ritual, because one should have a natural sense of what to do. On the other hand, he criticizes the Datiyim HaChadashim. That's another reason I bring him up, because he's one of the sharpest critics of the Datiyim HaChadashim, finding that the Datiyim HaChadashim have too much individuality, they have too much doing things on their own, that they're too self-centered, and that he makes it into a choice between this individualism or this Menschlichkeit, and he finds that a lot of these approaches don't have enough commitment and connection, too much living in the self, and not enough trying to be the patriarchs to emulate them. He finds connecting to God is natural. Once again, avoiding all the ideologies we've been dealing with, connecting to God should be something natural, as we see within the medievals. Okay. And he says he's surprised at himself because he always taught individualism. He always taught his students to be individualistic. Why are they not? Why is he not like this? Because he doesn't like all this freaky, he doesn't like all this anything goes stuff that's out there. He likes the individualism of the Ramchal, of the Gra, of the Kutsk and Slobodka, but the individualism of going to India doesn't speak to him. In terms of nationalism, in this he thinks that there should be a natural sense of naturalism. He believes that destruction of the state will come from the religious Zionist, the Merkaz world that's beginning to see itself and their messianic vision as greater than the state. And actually at the Gush dinner this year, he was absolutely livid about those who are protesting and saying that the messianism is greater than the state. And as I told you, he believes that even though it's a beginning of a messianic age is not the same as a messianic one. You can't apply any messianic thinking to today. Rav Kook's vision only applies when that messianic state really comes. In the meantime, we have to live with all the realism of the generals, all the realism of the secular side. So he's holding both sides at the same time.
Did you see the article yesterday?
Yes, I did. I can talk about that in a second. I would, and probably in a pile here somewhere. He believes what really counts is our own self-perfection, learning to think on our own. And what makes Rebbe Mital interesting is that he says you have to learn this by watching people, watch people at prayer, watch how they live their religious lives. I mean, he's actually, unlike all our ideologues, because like I said, we've done by now, whatever it's been, 28 weeks of ideologues. He says we actually learn by watching people in their naturalness, in their ethics, in their religion, and their appreciation of the state. And that's why I really felt compelled to end with somebody who tries to go out of their way to be non-ideological and seek some common core between everything. And as Mr. Harrison brought up, Yair Shelag had an article in 2 or 3 days ago on Rav Amital, bringing out, it's a very nice article, bringing out a lot of examples of him. And he calls the article a rare breed, this simple Jew, this Pashut Yid, about how in all of our ideological debates we've been doing, here's somebody who actually says, to be a Pashut Jew, and he respects you no matter which ideological position you actually take. And how at for his 80th birthday, there was a celebration, and how people on diverse sides who were his students, he respected all of them because they learned to think individually.